If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Warning, this podcast contains spoilers for Indiana Jones and A Dial of Destiny, as well as the first four films in the Indiana Jones franchise. My name is Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Rosie Knight.
And welcome to X-Ray Vision, the Crooked Media podcast, where we dive deep into your favorite shows, movies, comics, and pop culture.
In this episode, in the previously on, we are jumping into the Jeep or into the dinghy or whichever your preferred Indiana Jones themed travel method is.
The lead-lined fridge.
The lead-lined fridge, a very smart idea, I must just say. And we're going to look back on the Indiana Jones franchise to lead into our airlock, where we'll be talking about Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. And in Nerd Out, we have a theory on Secret Invasion.
Coming up, previously on. Bum bum ba-da-dum bum bum ba-dum bum ba-da-da ba-da-da-da. Here we go, folks. The legendary collaboration between George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, which produced the Indiana Jones franchise, which started with Raiders of the Lost Ark, 1981, followed by Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, 1984. Technically a prequel, we'll get into that in our recap. Followed by Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, 1989. Followed by Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, 2008. Followed this year with a resounding Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. But let's start with Raiders of the Lost Ark. Rosie, we open in 1936.
Oh, it's a long time ago.
And we meet intrepid archaeologist, tenured university professor, adventurer, and grave robber Indiana Jones on a mission to recover a golden idol from an ancient temple in the jungles of Peru, a place where he will return later in this series. His aide-de-camp double-crosses him, setting up a theme of the franchise.
Rude.
And he's nearly crushed by a boulder, but he does get out alive thanks to, you know, his guile and his trusty bullwhip. Unfortunately, the idol is then stolen from his hands by his rival in the field of archaeology, Dr. Belloc, and Indiana has to flee for his life. Back at university, where he is a teacher. And apparently fending off advances from his students at all times.
A lot of students.
We'll get back to this. Yes. The U.S. Army intelligence comes calling, and they tell Dr. Jones that they have unscrambled some communiques from a guy named Adolf Hitler, you may have heard of. And it turns out Hitler is obsessed with ancient artifacts, and the Nazis are currently digging for something in Egypt, and nobody knows what's going on. Jones is like, oh, I think they found this fabled legendary city where the Hebrew Ark of the Covenant is maybe kept in a place called the Well of Souls. And the U.S. Army intelligence guys are like, wow, I guess we came to the right guy. Tell us more. And it turns out the Nazis are also looking for a guy who specialized in the Ark of the Covenant named Abner Ravenwood. And Jones also knows him. Mm. More to the point, Jones knows Abner's daughter, Marion, and when I say no, what I mean is Jones used to have sexual relations with Marion when, in her words, she was a child, and You could do the math on how long she's supposed to be in the movie. It's a bad look for Sensing Dr. Indiana Jones. But it was 1981, and I guess, and things were different.
And I guess it was 1936 in his time.
Yeah, and things were also different. anyway, the army is like, okay, go after Abner Ravenwood. Jones knows where he is. He thinks he's probably in Nepal. He goes to Nepal. He finds Marion there. She's running a bar, and she is now a full-blown alcoholic. And honestly, the dark take on rewatch is like, because she's really mad at him, and that anger like bubbles over quite mm-hmm. easily. And it's that kind of like infamous snippet of dialogue where she says, like, I was a child, yada, yada, yada. He's like, the dark read on it is like she is medicating the trauma from mm-hmm. her relationship with full-grown adult Dr. Indiana Jones.
By living in a bar in rural Nepal and getting drunk every single day, drinking people under the bar.
But luckily she has probably the strongest liver of any human being.
She's powerful. I love Mary.
She's a very, very powerful. And again, a high functioning alcoholic. Mm-hmm. It turns out Abner is dead. But what about his artifacts related to Tanis, the city where the Ark probably is? What about that stuff? Namely a medallion. Is that still around? Marion's like, no. Come back tomorrow. Maybe we'll talk about it. Unfortunately, the Nazis are also in town, led by very ominous Gestapo officer Tote, and he is looking for the same stuff. Jones and Marion just barely escape with the medallion, but unbeknownst to them, Tote has a partial image of the medallion burned into his hand and at a high enough resolution that it's actually useful. Next stop, Egypt, where we meet Indy's friend and sometime fixer Gimli. Sala. His crew has been hired by the Nazis to do some digging, and Gimli says the Nazis are really stupid except for this guy, Baloch. And then Indy's like, no, you idiot, that's Belloc. Which, like, how did he, I guess he saw his name, like, on a call sheet? Like, how does that work? How do you get his name wrong?
I also just want to say, there are so many Kenner 6-inch remake figures of Belloc in every Target. So if you, I'm right. always like, why is he there?
Who was Belloc?
Who was Belloc? I mean, he does have a cool, like, kind of like a coat on, but like, yeah. I don't know, maybe he found one of the toys and that's how he gets the name now. How did he get it wrong?
But it turns out the Nazis appear to be close to finding the Well of Souls. Little does Indy know that he is being spied on.
But by who?
Well, it's the spy monkey. A spy monkey that is working directly for the Nazis. Oh,
I can't believe that monkey's a Nazi. I'm so disappointed in that.
I know. The Nazis, it turns out, have perhaps a team of spy monkeys, certainly at least one. And they set loose a team of assassins to kill Indy in the streets of Cairo. But of course, he escapes because we're only like 45 minutes into the movie. Spy monkey helps the Nazis capture Marion.
Rude.
And Indy, thinking Marion is dead, honors her in the way that she would like to be honored, which means he starts binge drinking.
Sensible.
Belloc calls for him and does some monologuing, basically says, like, you're the good version of me, but, you know, you're going to be me soon enough, and yada, yada, yada. And Indy is eventually saved from being murdered by Belloc and Belloc's assassins by a gang of street kids. Spy Monkey dies from poison dates, which allow Gimli to realize that the dates are poisoned, bad dates, and saves Indy's life. And Indy never thanks him, by the way.
Rude.
I think so. Indy sneaks into the Nazi camp. He finds the actual location of the Well of Souls because he knows that the staff that the Nazis are using is too long. He discovers Marion, who's still alive. But because the Ark is really the pressing thing right now, he leaves Marion in
Belloc's like, bye.
Bye.
Are you an ancient artifact that Hitler wants?
You're not.
Fuck off.
So I'll see you later. That night, Indy braves the Well of Souls, which is filled with snakes and other dangers.
He hates them.
Ed famously does not like snakes.
Not a fan.
not a fan, and he recovers the Ark. Meanwhile, Belloc has grown obsessed with Marion in a very short amount of time, and he gets her a dress that looks suspiciously like a wedding dress and asks her to wear it. And Marion, meanwhile, is plotting her escape, and so she figures, let's have a drinking game, which I'm really good at. She gets Belloc really, really drunk, and just as she's about to grab a knife and either stab him or just threaten him and escape, Gestapo officer Tote shows up with the most kinky clothes hanger of all fucking time. What the?
He's ready.
He was ready for some shit. And you know what? I want to stop here because we are going to talk about Dial of Destiny and the wonderful Mads Mikkelsen. And I love Mads Mikkelsen and everything.
Same.
I will never turn away the sight of the wonderful Mads Mikkelsen on any kind of screen I'm watching. But I will say, I do like, one of the things I like about Raiders is that the most ominous Gestapo officer is really just like a geek.
He's the one that you're meant to be scared of because he is like secretly the psycho. You know, you don't know what he's thinking. Like, that's a scary character. Also, like, I will say one of the most enjoyable things about these movies, which is, as we will get into, a very patchy and really terribly racist the further into them you get.
Yeah, they really quite are.
It is great to see just like Nazis are just getting killed. Now, earlier, Indiana Jones was killing some other people, didn't love to see it. But when he's killing a Nazi or somebody's beating up a Nazi or drinking a Nazi to an early grave, it's just that's a feel-good situation. I feel like that's part of why these movies have held such a long esteem is like it's very rare that you can watch a movie and feel good about people being killed. But Indiana Jones, you're like, come on, sorry, bro, you're a Nazi.
And Indiana famously has never, ever, ever been a Nazi sympathizer except when he slept with full-blown Nazi Dr. Elsa.
He didn't know she was a Nazi. Just saying.
We'll get to that in a bit. Okay. The next morning, Belloc intercepts Jones and Gimli as they are removing the Ark. Once again, he is right there. He takes the Ark for Hitler. The Nazis lock Jones in the Well of Souls along with Marion, much to Belloc's chagrin. But of course, they escape because now we're only an hour and 15 into the movie. Jones manages to steal the Ark back from Belloc. He loads it onto a ship board for the States. Jones and Marion share a cabin, which is... we're right back into it, I guess, trying to rekindle that old statutory magic. But Indy is too banged up to do anything, and he falls asleep. Aww. And, of course, the Nazis intercept the boat. They take back the Ark. They seize Marion and this was record scratch shit here for me. This is a movie for PG movie for kids. Despite the fact that the ship's captain is like, hey, leave the girl so we can use her to offset the costs of the trip.
Boo! Yes, tomorrow. Wow.
And again, a movie that I enjoy. I do enjoy Raiders, but this was a PG movie for kids.
They use the pulp trappings to do some to lean into their worst pre-code tendencies.
They're having a lot of, it's
based on stuff from a time when things were really racist and misogynist. So let's just go for it.
Let's just go for it. Belloc is absolutely thrilled to have his girl Marion back. Indy sneaks onto the Nazi submarine, rides it back to the Nazi Guns of Navarone-style base. He ambushes Belloc and the Nazis with an RPG. But then Belloc is like, come on. This is like a terrible climax to the film if you just blow us all up. Don't you want to see us open the thing? And Indy's like, yes, I do. That evening, Belloc intones a Hebrew prayer. He opens the Ark, and while cameras roll, magic fire melts everyone who is looking at the Ark, and Jones and Marion survive by not looking at it. Really smart by Indiana Jones.
Okay, so let's talk about this. So then, this is one of the most... The one thing I love about Raiders is like it is like a really pulpy B movie style film, right?
Yeah.
But it also is like an intrinsically interesting cinematic conversation starter, because you could arguably say, and it's been said by me in articles, it's been said in a now very famous Big Bang Theory cold open, probably the only time we will ever mention the Big Bang Theory on this show. But like, Indiana Jones does not really affect
any of the events
in this film. The end of the movie is God burning everybody's eyes out because they tried to touch the Ark of the Covenant. That would have happened whether or not Indiana Jones was involved. Now, arguably, him changing the stick, maybe, but someone else might have worked that out. Like, he doesn't really play much of a role in the actual actions of the movie. He does not move it along in the traditional way of a protagonist. And you could argue that the movie is the same with or without him. I just find that so interesting and weird.
I think it's very, very weird. And also, I mean, you know, Spielberg is just like in his bag because you don't notice. Like,
no, you never notice
that Indiana does nothing. The hero of the film does not do anything.
He is arguably not even the protagonist in the way that we understand what a protagonist is, because the Nazis would have died anyway. Like, arguably, you could say he changed whether or not they'd be able to open it. But I think you could argue that somebody else may have been able to do that. It's so weird. But like you said, this is a movie that's all about vibes. It's like, oh, you picked up like a pulp novel and you're just going with it and you wish it wasn't racist. But oh, look, there's like a cool, you know, a boulder's going to knock him over. He's running away from a boulder. By the way, just want to say that moment is actually directly stolen from a Scrooge McDuck comic, if you can believe it. Directly, there's a good comic book bit of knowledge for you. But yeah, like, you're just vibing on it, but it always makes me laugh. And in a recap, when you start to say it, it's just like, okay, so Indiana Jones gets there, doesn't do anything, they open it, everybody dies, and then he just like puts it in a warehouse.
Well, I think Spielberg was just, you know, Spielberg was on a truly the midst of a legendary, iconic cinematic run. And I think the way over the course of this film, they build up the Ark of the Covenant, build it up, build it up, build it up. You can get away with the final act of the movie being, hey, what the fuck's inside this thing? And watch us microwave
the original
all
Pulp
these
Fiction
Nazis.
Suitcase. It's like, you want to know what's in there.
It's also because there are essentially no special effects in this movie until this sequence. It just kind of knocks you back, especially the face melt, which remains incredibly powerful.
I mean, we all still think about it at like all times. Like, that's what one of the first things that you think about when you think about Indiana Jones. And one of the most interesting things is that actually was like so influential that there's like this also very offensive, I will just put that out there, but like a B movie called Street Trash that was directed by J. Michael Murrow. And it's like the whole movie is like that effect. It's basically that this booze gets infected and anyone who drinks it melts. And the movie was called like a melt movie. And it was kind of that trauma style thing. But that literally is just replicating the famous face melting sequence, which I watched so many times as a kid and also like absolutely devastated me and terrified me as a kid.
Oh, it's so scary.
It's so good. Actually, you know what? I think Steven Spielberg, you make a great point, because the truth is, if you think about the movies that he made his name with, Jewel, Jaws, you know, those movies actually a lot of fun.
Close Encounters.
Yeah, Close Encounters. I mean, those movies were actually very unconventional. Like Jaws, obviously you had all the issues with the shark, so you barely see the shark. And then when you do see it at the end, it's this huge impact moment and you create that really weird half underwater, half above water POV of
Close
the shark.
Close Encounters is one of the craziest slow burn movies of all time.
Ever.
Like nothing, almost
My guy's
nothing.
Just I'm making some mashed potato mountains.
Yeah,
just
but like, but in contrast to like a movie released today, almost nothing happens over the first like hour of that movie. It's
character
just one guy flipping out.
E.T., just a bunch of kids and like a weird puppet. So actually, in that way, the idea that he kind of made a protagonist-less movie where the character who is the titular character is not really the protagonist who drives on the story at all, that actually makes a lot of sense, because he was always doing things in a kind of unusual way.
He absolutely was. X-ray vision, we'll be back.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Tired of restless nights? Meet Lisa, the sleep experts. Here at Lisa, we know that good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. That's why their mattresses are made for exceptional comfort and support, catering to every sleep need. Check out Lisa's Sapira Hybrid Mattress, named Best Hybrid Mattress 5 years running. Sleep hot? The Chill Collection is built with cool-to-the-touch top fabric and layers of high-density comfort foams, all intended to remove excess body heat while maximizing comfort. With Lisa, getting a new mattress has never been easier. Delivery is free, and you have 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. Don't spend another night dreaming of better sleep. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to lisa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. That's leesa.com/iHeart. Exclusions apply. See lisa.com for more details.
And we're back. Raiders of the Lost Ark was followed by Temple of Doom. We open in 1935, so this is a prequel. And one of the most interesting things to me on rewatch was just what a different guy Indiana was only 1 year earlier. Of course, in Raiders, it's got to get it in a museum. This belongs in a museum. We got to get this in a museum. 1 year earlier, he's just like out here flipping artifacts for diamonds. Like, just seemingly the museum thing had slipped his mind at this point. Like, he's just out here looking for cash, like quick cash.
I'm guessing that he was like meant to be doing it for some other magnanimous reason, because he's always finding something to do. But really, I think they're essentially setting him up as a bit more of like a rogue who works on his own moral and ethical compass, because then we end up with the main MacGuffin of this, which wouldn't really necessarily work with the museum argument.
Agreed. And again, this Indiana Jones, a real hero, although roguish in Raiders, is not above like taking a dinner fork and sticking it into a bystander's ribs and saying like, I will stab this woman unless you give me what I need.
He is doing, this is one of the most bonkers cold opens of all time. And you can definitely,
it's wonderful.
Like, if they made movies like this today that were still like this and not like Dial of Destiny, they'd be like, each movie is going to take from a different time period and will showcase the different influences of filmmakers and choreographers. That is essentially what Spielberg was doing, but without any of the PR. Like, it's so different from Raiders and just absolutely bonkers.
This cold open actually might be my favorite thing in the entire series. It is in a movie that is crazy for its highs and lows. It's filled with adventure and excitement, has maybe the best personal relationships of any of the movies, but also is like horrendously racist. And this cold open is, it has madcap action. It is a wonderful homage to the musical work of Busby Berkeley with this kind of like wonderful dance routine that opens up with a full musical. Full
just like,
musical.
Sure.
Where we meet showgirl Willie, played by Kate Capshaw, later Steven Spielberg's wife. When we say highs and lows, I think the character of Willie is certainly one of the lows. She just exists to be like,
I'm a woman, everything, this
screaming,
is so terrible.
Oh my God, is that a spider?
Though her costuming is fantastic.
Fantastic. And Kate is a wonderful actress who does it with charm,
it was just
but they don't
give her a lot. That's, I think,
they
again,
don't give her anything.
That classic thing of like, oh, well, it's set in the old days, so we can make it as misogynistic as we presume. But actually, I just want to say, I talk about this a lot. When you actually go back and watch an old noir movie, actually, a lot of times, one, there were women directing them. Ida Lupino, The Hitchhiker, watch it. It's unbelievable. But two, a lot of times the female characters in them were actually like super complex and like weird and dark and smart and clever and funny. And I think this is almost where you get into that parody versus homage or whatever. They sort of think, oh, well, it's a femme fatale. It's like a woman. She's scared. She doesn't know what she's doing. That's how it was back then. And it doesn't actually really represent the era
she
of movies
no
they
fataling.
Were making. No, there's no
there's
fataling.
There's
no cool
fataling.
Double side. Yeah. I don't even know what this would be. She's like almost, she's almost the comedy relief, but she's
she
also
is the comic
not
relief
because
sure.
they don't give her a lot of like gags. It's not in the usual way. The jokes, she is at the butt of the jokes by being the one who doesn't want to go on the adventure, who doesn't want to be involved, who hates bugs.
She is kind of the, like Jones is the straight man and then they cut to her freaking out about like the horribly racist feast that they have the spiders or like
the monkey brains.
The monkey brains or the food in the village not being up to snuff, that kind of stuff. More about the highs, of course, this is the feature film debut of Kehi Kwan, who is wonderful as Indiana Jones's assistant fixer, young Short Round. The diamond deal that Jones is working on goes sideways. And so Dr. Jones, Willie, and Short Round have to escape via plane, which eventually crashes in the Himalayas. And Jones and company survive by sledding down the mountain in an inflatable boat, which they dive out of the crashing plane.
Unbelievable.
In. And so for
and
everyone
go down
who,
a mountain.
Go down
a
the Himalayas.
Mountain, a mountain in an inflatable dinghy. And every single one of you watched this as a kid and rewatched it as an adult and thought,
and
that
said,
looks
this
cool
is
as
fine.
Shit.
Yeah,
that
that's right.
Fine.
So remember this when we get to Kingdom of the Crystal Skull and the lead-lined refrigerator. Okay, they eventually come to rest near a village somewhere in northern India. Let's stop here. Mm-hmm. So the government of India read this script and said, this is like horrendous.
Racist.
It's offensive. It paints Indian culture in a inaccurate and horrendous light. Mm-hmm. And we'd like you to tweak the film, tweak the script to make it, you know, more an accurate depiction of Indian culture. And the production was like, no, let's just shoot in Sri Lanka instead. So the film was shot in Sri Lanka.
Just need to say, that is like the least you can do. Like, how hard would it have been to just be like, yeah, sure. Who noticed this in your office?
What's the bad
let's
stuff?
Let's talk to
what's
them for
the, well, for instance, we don't eat eyeball soup.
Yeah.
Or
you know what?
Live snakes.
If we do eat offal, we don't eat it out of a monkey's head. Every culture
and
eats
offal. And by the
offal,
way, every culture eats offal.
Thank you. But like,
blood sausage, anyone?
How little they were asked to do. And yet. Said no. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe that the little village that they built in Sri Lanka for this is actually still there. It was at least when I was younger. It was a tourist destination that people talked about quite a lot because they just left it there, as is the want of Hollywood production.
So Jones and company are like, hey, can you just send us to like the nearest town with a telephone? But the villagers are like, no, we need you to stop at the Maharaja's palace because our children are disappearing and we're all starving. And this is somehow connected to the theft of our secret Sankara stone. And so Indiana Jones, please go figure it out. Jones and friends go there. They meet the local British colonial forces. And they are treated to the aforementioned horrendous feast, which includes, as we mentioned, eyeball soup, live snakes, monkey brains, etc. stuff.
And not any rice.
Not real.
Like, just nothing. And not like, any real. No, not anything that you would actually see somebody eat. Just ridiculous, corny shit.
Jones discovers that a thuggy cult led by the ominous Molaram have been kidnapping local kids to use as slave labor to dig up the rest of the Sankara stones. And also Molaram does crazy stuff like pull the beating heart out of living people
Kalima.
All the time. He's doing this.
Kalima. He's just doing it all the time. He's doing
He's
it all
doing
the time.
It
Can't
on
help
a
it.
Regular ass basis.
Loves it.
The film has a really dark, gory tone that I actually quite like version.
It was the reason that when I was a kid, I would always return to this movie. Like, yeah. even as I got older and understood like how horrifically racist it was, like it seemed like a fantasy to me. But when I was a kid, so I didn't really put it together as much. But like the darkness, especially when you get into the voodoo kind of like horror elements. Even the feast actually is played very much for horror, which plays into horror, that horrific racist shit. But yeah, when you get down into the caverns and they're sacrificing the kids and everything, it's really bleak.
I mean, when Molo Ren pulls the heart out, it's like the face melt from Raiders.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's
and when
right
he almost
there.
Pulls they, it out of Indy, yeah. And you see it like pushing through the chest.
Oh,
I always remember
gosh.
That.
And then, of course, Indy is, you know, turned into a zombie, an evil zombie
shocking.
At a certain point, and it's really, really scary. And there's that, man, that scene that sticks with me even now when Short Round is like, I love you, Indy, please wake up. And Indy is, like, hitting him and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and Kei Kwan is crying, and then
yeah,
he actually burns Indy to wake him up. Very, very dark and very, very violent. In fact, 2 months after Temple of Doom's release, the MPAA, at the behest of Spielberg, would create the PG-13 rating because PG, this movie mm-hmm. and Gremlins really, really pushed the envelope of what PG could be.
Yeah.
Eventually, Indy, with significant help from Short Round, defeats Molo Ram, frees the kids, returns the Shankara stones, and the British colonial forces are victorious, gunning down many of the thuggy cult. End
yeah.
of movie.
How about he should have helped get rid of those colonial forces? Can I just say that? This was also just one of the only times, just wanted not to give Indiana Jones any credit, because I wouldn't like to do that, you know. But I will say, nice to see him return a stone. He'll just be stealing that stone to put it in a museum. You know, I'm glad. Good for him for returning that stone. Wish he'd learned a lesson there and continued that throughout his life.
We go to Last Crusade, and this is a film with a notably lighter touch than Temple of Doom, a mm-hmm. more adventurous, humor-filled movie. And I think it's the best movie of the franchise.
I think it's the best one. I think it combines what both movies did well and manages to eschew a lot of what they did less well. And yeah, just very fun. This actually has my favorite cold open of all the trilogy. One of the most impactful cinematic moments for me. I still think about it regularly. I think it's just wonderful. So yeah, this is a joy. I this is my favorite.
So that aforementioned cold open takes place in Utah. In the teens, we meet the young Indiana Jones with a wonderful long mop of surfer hair.
Played by River Phoenix.
Brought to life by the late River Phoenix, who is wonderful in this role.
It's so fun. You want to see a whole movie about him. It has this great train chase. You learn about why he's afraid of snakes, where he got his look, which is a really weird lore.
apparently like he just got his entire look from a guy who gave him a hat
after he bested him. Like, this guy literally
great.
Beats Indiana Jones as a child, and Indiana Jones is like, better just base my entire look, vibe, steez, aesthetic, everything,
yeah,
just gotta be based on him. As a teen, this kid was like, this shit's gotta be in a museum.
And by the way, as a team, he loved it. The zeal for museums, Cross of Coronado, that belongs in a museum. Even then, you know, young Indiana Jones was like, he was passionate about museums. Back in the present at school, Dr. Jones gets his dad's journal in the mail, and he discovers that his dad, who is a medievalist, has disappeared. Apparently, on a quest for the legendary Holy Grail, a.k.a. J.C.'s mug. Walter Donovan, the financier behind this quest for the Grail, invites Dr. Jones over, and he says, hey, why don't you go look for your dad? You know, we were really close to finding the... We were really close to finding the Grail. Why don't you go? Jones and his buddy, Dr. Marcus Brody, head to Venice on Dad's trail. There they meet full-blown Nazi beauty, Dr. Elsa Schneider, I guess, who's been working closely with Henry Jones very, very closely.
She lies about being a Nazi, but I feel like he's probably met enough Nazis to know she had big Nazi energy.
This is my issue.
Big
this
Nazi
is my
energy.
Issue. When, when people are like, well, okay, but he didn't know. She's like a blonde Austrian in 1938.
What are the chances?
Yeah, like, could we? Wouldn't you be like, hey, so.
So you're like, a Nazi?
You would kind of assume she's a Nazi, right?
I mean, you'd
at least ask.
I think he's like, well, my dad's working with her, so, you know.
Yeah, I don't
like,
want to know.
I don't want to. I'm just like, and, you know, yeah, the dad-son Elsa love. I always think about
also,
that.
Also, I love that they get a little bit of a gag out of, you know, the innate misogyny of the late 80s with the, oh, Dr. Schneider is a woman. No one ever could have seen this coming. Holy shit.
Oh, my God. Could you believe it? A beautiful woman? And she's not wearing, like, giant glasses and doesn't have, like, badly cut bangs? Also, I will say, when you get the reveal of Indiana Jones's dad being played by Sean Connery, that's like a top tier casting.
Indiana. Oh,
it's
my God.
So
it doesn't
good.
Get better than that.
It does not get better. They're so than good that. Together, too. Like, yeah, just enjoyable.
It's
enjoyable
a masterclass
shock.
For both of them.
Yeah.
Jones discovers that there is a tomb underneath the library in Venice, and there they find a knight shield, which has instructions that lead them to Iskenderun. There they discover that the Nazis have taken Henry to a castle in Austria. Jones sends Marcus Brody with the diary separately to Iskenderun to meet up with Gimli, and later he sleeps with the Nazi doctor.
Fun!
Okay. Indy sneaks into the castle to rescue his dad, but Elsa reveals herself now to be the full-blown Nazi that she indeed is, full-fledged believer in the Third Reich, double-crosses them. Indy and Henry escape. Henry slaps Indy for using Christ's name in vain, which is going to be a theme in this movie, is Dr. Jones is steadily indoctrinated into the Christian Catholic faith. The pair make their way to Berlin, where Indiana gets Hitler's autograph, and later they get out of town by sneaking aboard a Zeppelin and stealing a Luftwaffe plane. Crazy sequence!
You could not believe that all of that happens in the time that you just described it.
Insane sequence!
Unhinged.
Indiana fights more Nazis, as does the centuries-old secret sect who has been guarding the Grail all these years. Indiana rescues his dad and Dr. Brody from an out-of-control tank, which tumbles off a cliff. And it seems like Indiana goes over the edge, but you know what happens. You look at the clock. There's 30 minutes left in this mm-hmm. movie. Of course, he's still alive. And his dad, thinking that he was gone, embraces him. There's a wonderful, like, man, Harrison Ford is so good. There's a wonderful gag where Henry... Gimli and Marcus are all peering over the edge. They're shattered with grief. And Indiana, who climbed up, you know, some distance away, totters over to them and was like, what are they looking at? And looks over, and then they realize that he's alive. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's really good stuff.
Later, in front of the Grail's hiding place, the Nazis shoot Henry in order to force Indy to go in and find the cup. Inside, Indiana, as we mentioned, is indoctrinated to Catholicism, being forced to kneel, to read, you know, Christ's name.
But you know what? I will say, they make it look quite fun. Like, there's lots of adventures.
No,
like, you got to walk across,
this,
like, a cool bridge.
It's
like,
fantastic. He makes a leap of faith, yes, as you mentioned. He eventually meets a 2,000-year-old knight who shows him a selection of cups. Enter financier Walter Donovan, who's like, yes, finally. He picks the most Rick Ross style chalice and promptly dies of old age.
I mean, this is, even as a child, I was like, this man's
an
idiot.
This guy's
like,
not, yeah,
that
come
would
on.
Not, which cup do you think Jesus drunk
yeah,
from?
Yeah, the gold. The
you think
gold,
it, what was he? Was he a gold forger? No.
Yeah, come on.
He was a humble man and he was a carpenter, babe. Like, put two and two together.
Well, Indiana knows that. He picks the worst looking cup, and of course, it's the right one. He uses the cup to heal Dad's gunshot wound, and the Grail Temple falls apart. You know, as they take the Grail out, Elsa dies when she tumbles into
like,
a fog filled chasm.
Elsa? Now she's dead.
She's
died.
Just gone.
She's dying.
And you have to wonder, is Indy immortal now because
okay.
he drank from the cup?
I think
you have to keep drinking from it.
I think
right?
So. I think what it might be is like, I think about this a lot. because I was thinking about it when I was watching the new movie. I was thinking about it as a great excuse that they could have used if they wanted to recast Indiana Jones. So I think you have to stay within the seal of where the Grail is. And that's
right, like
why,
the three knights. That,
like why the soldier was there, the knight was there, and he was still old. And I think if you leave, I think it probably gives you some kind of like, you could argue that that's why he's still up and at him at like 85. Like it might have some residual, but I don't think you're getting that like 2,000-year-old. Like it seems like the purpose of the cup is to keep someone alive so they can protect the cup. You know, one of those good old weird narrative cycles. But yeah, I do think that they leave it open to interpretation.
Right. Well, before his job was to protect the cup, the that knight crusader's job was to just kill Muslim people in the Holy Land willy-nilly. That was his job. The crusades were going on.
I'm very glad that he has been trapped in that cave for 2,000 years. That's what he deserves.
Man, wait till he finds out what's going on outside. Woo! We go to Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And by the way, 15 years since Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, same as The Dark Knight. Is that not insane?
Wild.
What is it? Same as fucking nuts?
Same as like fucking Iron Man. Like what a year for the movies. if you'd have given people a choice of which movie would end up being more impactful, they would have probably chosen the fourth Indiana Jones movie.
I think that's probably like if you didn't know, off of experience,
Mm-hmm.
So it's 1957, the Cold War is ramping up, also aliens exist,
and Indiana Jones
has been doing clandestine missions for the OSS and later the CIA. The Russian agents, led by Galadriel, sneak into Area 51. They have also kidnapped Indy and his assistant Mac in Mexico, and they have brought the pair here because they want Indy to find this like steaming hot E.T. corpse hidden somewhere in the facility, and they think Indy's the guy to do it because he's seen one of these before. Also, the Ark of the Covenant is here, but nobody notices.
Nobody knows.
Jones leads the Russians to the hot pocket of alien meat. Then Mac betrays Indy to the Russians, who, again, Indiana remains terrible at picking adult.
Literally the most
The only
loyal
one who
person,
ever remained true to.
The only real one, and he never shows up again. One. What's wrong with you, Lucasfilm? What's wrong with the Indiana Jones? Mistake.
All the other adults that Indiana has ever contracted with eventually betray him.
Yeah,
it is
every
a theme.
Single time.
Indy manages to escape the clutches of the Russians, and he finds himself eventually at a town that is the Call of Duty map Nuketown.
Yes,
and Cannon. This turns out to be a setup for a nuclear bomb test explosion, so the army can see the damage that's going to be done. And all of a sudden, the warning siren goes off, and Indy realizes, "Oh shit, they're about to let off a nuke." He climbs inside a lead-lined fridge, which is blasted some 2 miles away from the site. It comes crashing to earth at like something like 60, 70 miles an hour. And Indiana Jones absolutely survives. He's fine with only some light radiation poisoning, which is then scrubbed off later at the local army base. He's fine.
I just want to say, this is no more ridiculous than going down the Himalayas in a dinghy. I think this is the least bad idea that is in this movie. Like, this is fine to me. Like, Indiana Jones, he's essentially immortal. You know, he's 57. No one knows what's going on with nuclear bombs yet. Like, everyone's dumb. He's in a lead-line fridge. Sure. Sure.
He is. He survives. And again, he has some amount of Holy Grail water running through his veins.
Exactly,
so he's probably a little bit more hardy than your average.
Yeah.
How old was he? 65 or something?
Yeah, you know,
at this
when
period
he's
in time?
When he's actually with the added protection of the lead-lined fridge and the Holy Grail, then it all makes
sense.
And
the Holy Grail juice.
Come on.
The FBI interrogates Dr. Jones, but they set him free in large part because like a general who he worked with is like, do you know who this guy is? He's been doing secret missions for us for years and you got to let him go. Jones goes back to work at Marshall University, but again, Cold War tensions are really ramping up. The Red Scare is happening at this time, and the FBI has been, you know, like taking away Dr. Jones' personal effects and the stuff from his office. And so the university is very, very sensitive at this time to being accused of harboring a commie. And so they tell Dr. Jones, you have to go on permanent leave or extended leave. I forget exactly how they phrase it.
You're out, basically.
You're out of here.
You're out of here.
We learn right around here that both Marcus and Henry Jones have passed in recent years. Then there's this weird sequence where Jones boards a train, but then gets off the train. So yeah. Dr. Jones is like, I'm going to New York to find my fortunes in New York City and figure out what my next move is. He gets on the train, but then a biker named Mutt just rides along the platform.
And he's wearing a really memorable hat.
Looks like Marlon, like a Marlon Brando cosplay. And this, yes! of course, is...
Exactly.
This gentleman is played by the now canceled Shia LaBeouf. And... This is Mutt. And Mutt has news. He says, hey, Harold Oxley, do you know him? And the audience is like, no, I've never heard of this guy. But luckily, Indiana Jones has heard of him. And Indiana Jones is like, yeah, my buddy, the ox. And he's like, yeah, the ox is going to be killed because he found a crystal skull in Peru. This means something to Indiana Jones, who gets off the train. And Mutt further tells Indiana that his mom, Mary, who managed to escape the assailants, pointed him in Jones's direction, saying this guy can help. Ox was apparently heading towards a legendary city called Akator. He and Mutt end up escaping the KGB, who Indy realizes behind all the nefarious stuff going on in this movie. And we realize it, too, because Cate Blanchett is in the beginning of this movie with a Rocky and Bullwinkle accent. So you realize that this is going to be the big bad of the movie. Ox's trail leads them back to Peru. Indiana Jones back in Peru.
He's back.
At the grave of conquistador Francisco Orellana, Indy and Mutt are attacked by weird poison dart wielding killers, and they never come back.
Another throwback to the original movie.
In the grave, the pair follows drawings of oblong-shaped skulls to various mummified conquistadors, including Orellana, and they eventually discover a big old crystal skull, which could not have been made with human technology. Indy finds, unfortunately, Mac and a bunch of Russian soldiers are waiting outside for them. Indiana, again, is always getting ambushed outside.
Every single time.
They take Mutt and Indy to the jungle, where Indy is reunited with Ox, who is now apparently insane, driven insane by the crystal skull. The Russians want the skull because the skull can give you psychic powers, and they want to create this psychic army and beat the Americans. Yeah, okay. Indy uses the skull to make Ox kind of sane again. Then Galadriel is like, guess what? Look who I got. And produces Marion, who reveals that she is Mutt's mom, and Mutt is Indiana's son.
Whoa! I think they're trying to set up a new franchise.
I think they are. And it looks like, we have to say, Marion is no longer drinking, which we love.
No, I love that. Love Karen Allen. Happy to see her back here. Marion, yes. Ravenwood, good job.
The Russians say, listen, we're going to kill your longtime love, Marion, even though you never hardly... talk to her, write her, whatever, in 15 years
or something.
But we're going to kill her unless you help us. And so this means that Indy, Mutt, Marion, and Ox have to escape, and escape they do. There is this like kind of slapstick gag with what is like a substance that is not quicksand, yada, yada, yada. Eventually, Jones and the Russians find Akator, the repository of the skulls. An alien reassembles itself out of skeletons. That happens. Galadriel is driven insane when the alien downloads all of the alien knowledge into her mind, which is what she wanted. But like, come on. What did you think they were going to do?
Put it on a fucking hard drive. Put it on a little floppy disk.
Yeah, something like that.
I feel like you're doing a great job of summing up just how absolutely off the rails the end of this movie goes. I do think the first half of this movie is a very rompy Indiana Jones joint. I think so too. You know, I think Indiana Jones would be seen as a communist because he's a little bit liberal minded. I think there's interesting things at play here. And then it's like an alien downloads its brain into Cate Blanchett's skull. Mutt and Indiana Jones swing through the CGI jungle next to the monkeys. And then an alien makes itself. Also, why did they make so many skulls and why did they leave them on Earth? If you have these powerful skulls that will lead... that will give people psychic powers.
Classic alien
Why did
stuff.
You just like just chilling? Oh, you know what? Maybe these humans need to be psychic. Maybe that would help.
We should note that once again, Spielberg has gone back to the toolkit and decided that the hero will not do anything to solve the issue between he and the antagonist.
It worked for
Raiders. It is in fact the alien downloading its brain who gets rid of the Russian top KGB agent. The alien then flies off in a UFO through an interdimensional portal. More interdimensional portals to come in this franchise. Mm-hmm. Indy gets his job back and marries Marion. The end. Which brings us to Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny up next in the airlock.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between award-winning mattress brand Leesa and home design favorite West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is the culmination of these two companies' shared values: premium materials, meticulous craftsmanship, and sustainable practices. Made with natural latex, responsibly sourced natural wool, and environmentally safe foams, the Natural Hybrid elevates your sleep sanctuary, indulges your senses, and supports a greener tomorrow. Plus, when you purchase the Natural Hybrid, you're also helping fuel Leesa's work with shelters and those in need. Since 2015, Leesa has donated more than 40,000 mattresses to ensure children and families have a safe place to sleep. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Leesa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit Leesa.com/iHeart. That's Leesa.com/iHeart.
Okay, folks, we're stepping out of the airlock and into the year 1969, the year in which the Knicks would win their first of two championships for Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, directed by James Mangold, written by Jez Butterworth, John Henry Butterworth, David Cope, James Mangold, of course, based on characters by George Lucas and Philip Kaufman. Music, wonderful music by John Williams, starring the 80-year-old Harrison Ford as Henry Jones,
he's
a.k.a.
old.
Dr. Indiana Jones, Phoebe Waller-Bridge as Helena Shaw, the wonderful Mads Mikkelsen as Jürgen Völler, Antonio Banderas, wonderful surprise as Ronaldo.
Surprised. I didn't know.
Yeah, John Rhys Davies, who
he's
I'm
back.
Not even going to look up. He's back, folks. Toby Jones in a brief role as Basil Shaw, and more, Karen Allen also making a wonderful appearance. Should we try and recap it first before we talk
you
about
the... You want to do it by memory?
Yeah, we want to try and do it by memory? Let me see. Right. So we open in 1969 and Dr. Indiana... No, actually, we open in the last days of World War II. There is... Indiana Jones is a prisoner at some Nazi fortress, and he is taken prisoner... along with his buddy Basil Shaw. They're here looking for like a spear that was used to stab Christ, but it turns out that's a fake. And the actual thing that the Nazis are after is the Antikythera mechanism, which was created by Archimedes and which eventually you will discover can allow people to travel through time, through fissures in time.
Yes. It is the closing days of World War II, and Indiana Jones and Basil end up on a plunder train, which is the Nazis trying to steal all the shit. And they're like,
they're
we got
to
stop.
Further east.
They're like, we got to stop. We got to stop. We got to get this train. We got to take this stuff to a museum. I fucking love museums. Museums are so important. But Mads Mikkelsen, looking a little bit de-aged, but still looking good. Harrison Ford, very de-aged.
Very de-aged.
Better de-aging than we've usually seen, I will say.
Toby It's up and down.
Don't look at the mouth too much. If you look at the mouth too much, it gets a bit Superman in Justice League.
Can I, they should have de-aged the voice because that is the voice of an 80-year-old.
He is hoarse. He is feeling, I was feeling like he had a cold. I am a big, as you know, as I said earlier, I love River Phoenix as young Indiana Jones. I'm saying cast a different actor. It would be fine. Oscar Isaac, Indiana Jones, Sebastian, what's his name? He's the Winter Soldier. You know, there's all kinds of young men you can play. You can have play him. I was going to say Sebastian Shaw, like he was in the Hellfire Club. But anyway, he's looking de-aged. They're on the train. It's very CG heavy. But Mads Mikkelsen is there, Jürgen Voller, and he really wants the Dial of Destiny. He believes.
He wants that dial.
He believes.
Guess what? Dr. Jones and his buddy Basil kind of foil this. We flash forward to 1969, where Indiana Jones is living in New York City. He's old. He doesn't like that his young neighbors are partying and blasting the Beatles.
His students don't care anymore.
They don't care anymore. Nobody cares about archaeology anymore. And all anybody wants to do is get high and go to Lovin's and go to Woodstock and
listen to
Grateful Dead and like fucking watch the telecast of the moon landing.
How dare they
try not to go to the war. How dare they do this? Anyway, Dr. Jones makes the acquaintance of Helena Shaw, his goddaughter, who he won in a string of women who he abandoned over the course of his life, for like 20 years.
Her dad went insane because of the Dial of Destiny, a.k.a. the Antikythera, a.k.a. Archimedes' Dial, which Indiana Jones gave to him, may I just say. And then Helena, like, runs a little scam on Indiana Jones, and she's like, bro, where's the dial? I want to find it. I want to become, like, a famous archaeologist like you. But my dad said you lost it. We know that didn't happen. We know Indy gave it to him. And Indiana Jones is like, I think that's not what happened, but I trust you. So, because you're an adult and you're going to help me. And that's gone really well for me in the past. So he takes her to his little office in his school in downtown Manhattan. Sure. The college is there on the street. And there's a big parade.
Hunter College, too, I believe it is.
Yes, yes, yes. And there is a huge parade going on for the astronauts who have come back successfully from the moon landing. And Helena and Indy go there and he shows her, I actually have the Dial of Destiny. And you know what? You can have it because I trust you. Bad choice. Because Helena betrays him. She locks him in and he gets chased down by an interesting collection of FBI/CIA agents and Nazis who are working together.
That's right. Because it turns out, folks, that our good friend Jürgen Voller is in the States now as part of Operation Paperclip. Mm-hmm. He is one of the Nazis who the U.S. government has tapped to help with the rocketry program, which put the astronauts on the moon that everybody is celebrating. And so apparently because of this, Jürgen Voller has like a lot of leverage and just gets to like assemble his only like mercenary Nazi crew.
To find the Dial of Destiny.
Yeah, under the watchful eyes of the CIA who are watching his Nazis like just murder regular people in the streets and like people who work at Hunter College. Mm-hmm. And they just like look the other way and go, well, I don't know, this guy like invented rockets, so we can't do anything.
You know, he is a Nazi war criminal who's openly racist to people in America. But don't worry about it. He created a rocket. So turns out, thanks to Sala, the returning John Rhys Davis, turns out Helena is a little scammer. She's been selling antiquities. She's not an archaeologist. She's a survivor. She doesn't like museums. She's taking them from a museum, but she's not giving them back. She's selling them to the highest bidder. So that means Indiana Jones has to go to Tangier, and so does Jürgen Voller and his crew of like Nazi CIA agents.
Right. Who then shoot one of the CIA agents and just kill her dead. And
R.I.P.
the American government response,
like, the only interesting
is like nothing.
Character.
She was interesting and then they killed her off.
Yeah.
So a lot of stuff happens. You know,
there's
they
many
go into
chases.
Tombs. There's many, many chases.
You go in a little tuk-tuk chase. Jürgen has the Dial of Destiny. Helena has the Dial of Destiny. Indiana Jones has the Dial of Destiny. Lots of MacGuffin swapping.
Then Jürgen with Helena, a.k.a. Wombat, apparently has killed her, and with Dr. Indiana Jones at again a spry age of 80 as his prisoner, flies off with the Dial of Destiny in a period correct Luftwaffe transport plane in search, using this dial, of a Fisher through time that will deliver him to 1938-39. I forget the exact year.
I believe it was.
With the idea, get this twist, Rosie, to kill Hitler.
Oh,
Jurgen,
my God.
Jurgen is like, Hitler fumbled the bag. I'm smarter than him. Put me in, coach. I want to play as the Fuhrer. I'm going to go in there. I have a meeting with Hitler. I know the date of the meeting with Hitler. I'm going to meet the guy. I'm going to kill him. And then I guess the Nazis are just going to coalesce around me. They're not going to put me to death for killing the Fuhrer. They're going to all coalesce around me as the leader, and I will lead Nazi Germany to victory in World War II. That's his plan.
Yeah, it seems silly. But okay, it was a good twist. It was like they were like, what about if a Nazi wanted to kill Hitler? And then they were like, but he's the bad guy, so how do we make him worse? Well, Hitler was stupid, and I'm gonna be a better Hitler. Okay,
that's
so then
right, I'm gonna do it better than him.
But guess what? Archimedes was, according to Indiana Jones, Archimedes, idiot.
He didn't know about continental drift.
He didn't put that in his math. So guess what? They fly through the fissure in time, followed by the hilarious 12-year-old Teddy, who is Helena's like sidekick, and he can also fly a plane. Good for him. So then these two planes end up going through the fissure, and they're not in Nazi Germany. Good. They are in Sicily, which is where they were meant to be, but it's like 314 BC.
Yes, something like that.
Something occurred.
And the late Roman Republic, mid Roman Republic, Middle Roman Republic is busy laying siege to Syracuse, where Archimedes lives. And long story short, folks, what we find out is that Archimedes actually rigged the Dial of Destiny because he needed help. He knew he was going to need help in this siege to fight off the Romans. And so he created this dial with the hopes that whoever finds it would go back through the time fissure with some help so that they could fight off the Romans.
And they scare the Romans off because they're in two planes and the Romans think they're dragons, and that helps. And also the dial is essentially a trap because it will never go anywhere else.
Archimedes, it only goes to the siege of Syracuse.
So you'll go into you'll go in there. Archimedes also keeps Jürgen Waller's watch. He's like, this is useful. I feel like that is a steampunk level time change. Like, steampunk is based on the idea that, like, what if people had invented a computer in the Victorian age? Very, very paraphrased there, but generally that's the idea. I feel like if there was a watch in 314 BC, the entire world would have changed. I feel like that is enough of technology. But who am I don't know anything. I don't know anything about time travel or Archimedes. So Indiana Jones decides he wants to stay. I don't know why, because he loves history.
We should add, it is actually 213 to 212 BC.
Of Syracuse.
No. What do we know?
We don't know anything. We're not historians.
One of the fun things, kind of fun things, and I don't know how purposeful it is, about this movie is, so Jürgen Waller was taken to the U.S. as part of Project Paperclip, in which the United States was acquiring geniuses to help their military, projects. And interestingly, part of the Siege of Syracuse was part of a larger struggle against Carthage, but the Romans were well aware of the genius of Archimedes and had orders to capture him alive and bring him back to Rome so that he could build all these fantastic contraptions like the ones he had built to defend Syracuse. So he was going to be kind of the Jürgen Waller of
this time. It's a nice narrative echo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, Dr. Jones has been wounded in this whole thing, and he's bleeding out. And he's like, they get to meet Archimedes, and they speak Greek to him, and apparently Greek of 213 BC is just like Greek
now.
Exactly
the same.
And so they converse with him, and Diana Jones is like, leave me here in 213 BC.
He's like, I don't have nothing to live for. My son, by the way, sorry, we should have mentioned this earlier. But
oh, yes.
I was,
you
by the way,
the son.
R.I.P. Mutt, he died in Vietnam. They killed him off.
Oh, he died in Vietnam. Probably because he was trying to knife people instead of using guns.
I'm saying he had a lot of problems, so that spinoff never occurred for him, even though he did pick up the hat at the end of Kingdom of the
Crystal. He did pick up the
hat,
but. Will never get to use it because he died in Vietnam.
And that is incredibly harsh, but gave me a chuckle. And Indiana Jones, the worst thing about it is Mutt only signed up just to piss off his dad because his dad didn't
like the
war.
The way they drop that in the course of his conversation with Archimedes is so fucking funny. Like, I don't have anything to live for.
He's got nothing to live for, man. Like, his son's
Mark
dead.
Went to Vietnam.
Mutt went to Vietnam. Marion left him. He doesn't want to do the effort to make that relationship work. He's just going to stay in Rome, okay?
That's right.
That's what men
leave
do.
Me,
he's going to stay.
Leave me in ancient Sicily in 213 BC.
Literally.
I want to live here. I want to die here. The Romans
men,
are about
he's
to
also
kill
been
everyone
shot,
here.
So he's going to die he's, soon.
He's
men will literally
gonna die.
Fly through a fissure in time and go back to ancient Rome instead of going to therapy, apparently. So he's there. Helena's like not having it.
Helena talks. Yeah, she talks some sense. Well, socks some sense.
Yeah, she punches him in the face,
Jones.
And she's like, "You're out, bro. We're going
right,
back to New
York." And
then
carries him aboard Teddy's little plane, and Teddy's little plane, which is already carrying Teddy and the rightful pilot of the plane, who is asleep in the back.
Hilarious, unnecessary Indiana Jones gag, by the way. That was like, I was like, sure.
Why is
that
we
guy.
Don't need that guy, but he was there, and now the plane, this little ass plane, has to carry. Has to carry
and they don't
the
show
rightful
it
pilot,
because
little Teddy,
Helena,
Wombat,
and what? Yeah, and Indiana
and
Jones.
An unconscious Indiana Jones back through the fissure, and it does. And so they end up back in 1969 in New York City. Indiana Jones wakes up in his apartment. He has been nursed back to health by Helena and Marion, who has arrived and apparently decided, you know what, this guy is a toxic, shitty partner mm-hmm. who started messing around with me when I was of
a
an
child.
Illegal age,
let's,
an age when
say.
I could not absolutely consent to whatever was going on. And then later, even after we said, like, you know what, let's get hitched and let's finally do the thing, I guess abandoned me because he can't, ever stop heeding the siren call of artifacts from other cultures. And so, but you know what, he's been shot in and has just come back from 213 BC and so I am just absolutely going to put the groceries away in his refrigerator and we're going to patch things up, and they patch things up.
Yeah, that actually, I have to say, from the whole movie, that was the moment that really like emotionally resonated for me. I just think because I think Karen Allen's fucking great, and I will say I just want to give Karen Allen some props here because she has talked quite extensively. This was the quote she said: "I had thought that I would majorly a part of the film." So she was under the impression that originally she thought that she was supposed to be a major role. She told that to the Hollywood Reporter. And she was kind of surprised that in the end, because originally I guess Steven Spielberg had been working on this movie and she was meant to be more of a role. And then that changed when James Mangold came in. I would have liked to see more. I thought that was one of the most, most emotionally resonant moments. And it was just lovely. And I was happy for them. So, like, good for them. But also, you made many good points. I kind of wish Marion had moved on and gone to therapy too and found a more healthy partner. But you know what? They got a nice apartment in New York. The sun's coming
they
through the window. You can dry
it's
a hat
be a
out there.
It's going to be a multi-million dollar apartment in like soon. 20, 30 years when Indiana Jones might still be alive at
He's
like 130 years old.
He's got that juice running through him, baby.
Old.
The juice is running through him. He could do it.
Okay. So here's the thing about this movie, which is fine.
It's fine.
It's perfectly fine movie. It is a bomb, certainly in the context of its 300 plus million reported budget, 350 yes. to 400 million. It only made $60 million in an opening weekend and then dropped off precipitously. And gosh, let's talk about why. Let's talk about that budget first, because reported 350 to 400. I
before
one, don't believe that. I don't believe that there's any way this movie. I don't. Yeah, it has to be something weird going on.
Yeah,
because there is no way this movie cost $350 million. One did, and two, it does not look like it.
If it did, it didn't make it to the screen. I think that was my biggest struggle with this movie. Is like, look, the movie one is too long, 2.5 hours long. Don't need it. Should have been 2 hours long. Should have been 90 minutes long. I know we say that a lot on here. Look, sometimes I love a long movie, yeah? And I know movies like Endgame is really the one that made it seem like, well, look, this is like almost a 3 hour long movie and people will go and watch it 5 times in the cinema. That has changed post-COVID. What people will choose to go to the cinema to see and rewatch, and they know this will end up on Disney Plus soon. You can make a shorter, thriftier, more efficient movie, and a lot of times it's going to people can see it more times in the cinema, you can show it more times, and it can be a more bracing experience. This, I've watched the Indiana Jones movies so many times. Lucasfilm was like a religion.
Many times.
In my house growing up, right? Like VHS, Lucasfilm.
You could not avoid it.
Goonies, all that stuff. Yes. Like, and the truth is, I've seen all of them, and this movie didn't have that bracing engagement, even in the way of like a Temple of Doom, which like we said, is like so horrifically racist. That would get you caught up in the emotion, in the way that the movie was made. And then you're like, oh, I wish it wasn't like this, or oh, I'm going to turn it off, this bit's really fucked up, or whatever. This movie is very by the book, modern Hollywood blockbuster. I don't even think it really fits into the cool kind of requel style, because Indy is the main character. They don't do a great job building a new character that you want to follow, and it doesn't seem like they're interested in doing that. Like, it doesn't feel like they're trying to set Helena up for anything here, but it also feels like they don't really say goodbye to Indy in a concrete way. And I agree with you. I think the biggest problem for me was, like, visually, there were cool sequences, but I missed that practical. I know I sound so old. I'm sorry, but I am an old person. Same. Like, I can't help it. When I think about we talked about the River Phoenix opening to Last Crusade, you know, on the train. There's so much fun seeing him scrambling around on that train, like having this adventure. There's a huge train fight sequence here, and it's all CG. And they're de-aged, and the rain is CG, and the train is CG, and everything else is CG. And it just misses that, you know, the boulder chasing Indiana Jones.
Yeah, there's a lack of visceralness.
It doesn't feel real. It also feels almost too slick, which is kind of goes against the pulpiness. And not necessarily slick in a good way, but like visually actually slick. And, you know, super producer Chris brought up it before we were talking about it. And I thought about it too, because obviously they showed the Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning trailer before this movie. There's a huge train sequence in that. And we know it was practical. And that movie apparently cost almost $100 million less than the highest end budget of this movie. I understand Harrison Ford's old, but like maybe that should make you question the situation. I just feel like the lack of practical, the over CG, it was hard for me to connect in an emotional way with the characters until really that like quiet moment at the end with Marion and Indiana Jones. And I think a lot of that did come from that. It's doesn't look like it costs that much money, and it feels like a lot of the heart of the old movies is missing. And I think a lot of that is to do with those visual choices.
Yeah, I think moreover, when talking about this movie's disappointing box office performance, I haven't seen anybody talk about this, but this movie has attempted to do something that no other movie has done, which is sell a reported $350 million budget movie and earn a massive return for a vehicle whose star is 80.
Yeah, an action vehicle.
This has never been done
this
before.
When you said this, I thought this was really a great point that kind of people aren't really talking about. It's almost an untested product, even though it's an IP.
Yeah, it's never been done before. Put a person this old in the starring role of an action movie. Budget action movie.
We were talking about this like in the group chat, and like, the funny thing is about it, the closest comp is like an Expendables movie, right? And those guys are like 20 years younger, and there's about 10 of them in the last one, Expendables 3. And that movie made like $200 million. So it's not even, a billion-dollar version of this that has been done, even to the closest comp.
You could point at like Lionsgate stuff, and say, you know, John Wick is older, Taken, Liam Neeson and Taken.
You're still talking like 30 years younger.
You're still talking about like in their 60s. Like mm-hmm. Harrison Ford again is 80. And I understand with the de-aging, but let's say the de-aging was seamless. You know how old he is. I know how old Harrison Ford is. I know that.
I feel like they've done it enough times now to know that I don't think audiences really respond well to de-aging. I just think it's like, just cast someone younger. Sebastian Stan, the person whose name I did not give the credit to. So many people wanted to see him as a young Luke Skywalker for years. Yeah. There were all these conversations about how he looked like Mark Hamill when he was younger. You know, the idea of casting someone new is exciting. I understand that we had the Han Solo experience, which didn't necessarily hit in the right way. But then
I think a better movie, I'll say it again. I think a better movie than people remember, but yeah, continue.
Yes, I agree too. And also I will say, I think as well, arguably a character who we already knew his younger version of. So maybe you don't need to do that. But when you're returning a character, Luke, you know, Indiana Jones, if you want to do that, don't be afraid to cast a new person, guys. The de-aging is scary. It's given Uncanny Valley.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, that it's a thing that nobody's really talking about, which is mm-hmm. the kind of unprecedented nature of trying to execute this level of movie with a star in his 80s. And then I think secondarily, listen, Shia LaBeouf is not the right guy. But one thing that I think Crystal still did kind of do right was pick that co-star who could have ostensibly taken the mm-hmm. reins of the series, who made, I love Phoebe Waller-Bridge. I'm not sure that that's the right actor. And she's good in this role.
She's good, but it's also like, I thought there was some cool aspects there, the idea of Helena kind of being a criminal and stuff and not necessarily having, but it didn't grab me as a character I wanted to particularly know more about, or I would have liked to see a younger, more action-focused star. Ella Balinska, I love you. I'm always trying to get you these roles. But like
someone buzzier, I'm just saying, like, if you're thinking about making
also
this
someone who's
reported $350 million back.
I want to see someone who's doing stunts. If Harrison can't do the stunts, give a young person a stunt.
Someone's got to do them.
Someone's got to see it. Someone's got to do a stunt, please. I just want to see one stunt. You know, it's, I think, so what do you, I feel like you made another great point when we were talking about this, like before, which you kind of were like, I think it's also about quality. These box office numbers, you know, let's talk about it. Make a good movie. I feel like that is really like a big problem with The Flash. I feel like if they'd have made a really great movie, even despite the controversies or the runtime or anything else, people will find it and go to it. Look at something like Elemental, right? I have yet to see it, but that Pixar movie.
The movie
didn't do well in its mm-hmm. opening run. It was Pixar's biggest flop, especially if you consider inflation since, you know, Toy Story, which obviously was an untested first movie. So that didn't make a lot of money the way Pixar movies do now. But every week that movie has been making money because it had an A- cinema score, I believe, and families are going to see it and it is still finding an audience. Now, will it still be a loss leader? Maybe. But I think that the quality of it and the fact people want to see the film tells you everything you need to know about it. There's a reason Spider-Verse didn't flop. It was fucking brilliant. Like, I feel like they're too concerned about the IP and not as concerned about telling a good story.
Yeah, that to me is really, when people talk about IP fatigue and Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny possibly being an example of IP fatigue, and, you know, you can point at any number of stories about various Marvel projects,
franchise fatigue,
and the big screen, franchise fatigue. I think at the end of the day, it's kind of like, this is dead obvious, and I'm not saying that it's easy to make something good, but just make something good. Like Indiana Jones and Dial of Destiny is a perfectly fine movie, but it's not like great. Mm-hmm. And if you want to make people sit back in their seats and spend tons of money, and you want to be able mm-hmm. to recoup that reported $350 million. Again, I don't understand how this possibly could have cost $350 million. Then your best bet is to come out with something that's really just gangbusters. And this is just not, it's not. So like when people are like, oh, it's not a hit, it's also not a
great movie.
It's not a great movie.
Yeah. I also think, so I think something that kind of I think about a lot as well is like, why do you make it, right? Is it because So The Flash suffered from that because it was originally meant to be this like ground. Originally, it's a Flash movie. Then it's a groundbreaking repurposes the DCEU. Then it's not that. So it loses the why did it get made? And you don't necessarily get some great retelling or important new story, which, you know, a lot of what happened in The Flash, as I've said many times, already happened in the CW. Like, why did they make it? Indiana Jones feels like that to me, especially when it's coming from someone like James Mangold, who, you know, made Logan, which is like one of the greatest comic book movies ever made, a truly great movie. That's a movie where you felt like, oh, I need to know this about the character. I'm so glad I saw this story. This Indiana Jones didn't tell me that. I didn't know why this needed to be added to the lore. You know, that's where I think people start to feel like, is it a bit of a cash grab? There's not necessarily something new. I also think it's interesting to try and still be telling a story that was nostalgic to the men who made it in the 80s. Like, Indiana Jones was pulpy and nostalgic to George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. They wanted to recreate a storytelling tradition that they had enjoyed as children, and they wanted to bring it back and do their own version. Do we still need to be trying to tell that story like 50 years later with no reconsideration? That's kind of what I was thinking a lot in the movie, was like, how do you tell a cool pulp story in an unexpected, different way? That's what I think they didn't do with this. I think they tried to make it too much like the originals. And instead, I think there is a cool space to tell an Indiana Jones story that subverts or recontextualizes or adds to the lore. And I don't necessarily think this did that. And I think people do want that when they come to an IP or franchise storytelling.
And then my final thing about why maybe it doesn't work, I don't know about if this necessarily led to it bombing the way it did, but one of the things that kind of I thought could have been better, we're going to cover the Mission Impossible franchise, and we're going to cover Mission Impossible 7. And I thought one of the things that Fallout, 2018's Fallout, did really well,
I love that was movie.
Was underline that Ethan is getting older and he's not as good as he used to be, and he can't fight the bad guys alone anymore. It takes him a little longer to get up. And there's some of that with Indiana Jones and Dial of Destiny.
It's more done in a gag way, though.
It's done in a gag way, though. It's done as like as comments.
It's show, don't tell. And it's also about what that means for the state of the world. If he can't be the hero we need, what with Indiana Jones, it's like, I'm climbing up a giant mountain, but my knees are sore.
I got to take a break now, you know? And that's really the only moment where you're like, okay, he's showing his age, but like calling it out, you're right, weakens it. And furthermore, it's not like they avoid the subject of how old Indy is. Like, it's a
constant topic,
right? But he's still fighting the Nazis. He's still like climbing out of windows. He's still leaping onto the back of a horse. Which you understand is a de-aged face swapped thing with a stuntman on the back of that horse. but there's no show. It's all, hey, you're old now. Hey, old man. Hey, old guy. Hey, how old are you?
And very secret invasion. Like, you're washed. Did anyone tell you you're washed?
But there's no like, there's very rarely Indiana Jones like trying to catch his breath or being like, I can't get up. Or he's still getting up. And there's that moment, which you mentioned, when they're climbing out of the tomb. But that's it for the show part of it. And it felt disingenuous to me. Unless they really lean into he's got the grail juice in him.
And they didn't do that. Because I'm going to say,
that I would have liked.
Everybody knows, if you listen to this podcast or you read the stuff that I write or whatever, I love like fun out there stories. So you're rarely going to hear me say this, but I did feel like for once this could have done with being a bit more like grim and gritty. And I'm like, I rarely say that. But his son died. Like, I want to see how that impacted him. He's old. He can't do it the same way, but he's got to go on this mission. I feel like there could have been some gravitas and grit that we didn't get.
The emotional culmination of this film for Indiana Jones is him begging to be left in ancient Greece where he wants to die. Like, and that could have really been an emotional, like, gut punch if some of that feeling of his impending mortality was more spread out through the film.
Yeah.
But you really never feel that.
You
don't feel that. And I think, and here's another take. The de-aging, we talked about, like, get a younger actor. I think if you didn't do the de-aging and if you got a younger actor, or you just told the whole story in the present, then we could have sat with an older Indiana Jones. And really let that kind of melancholy, that emotional impact of this guy, and how long is he going to be with us, and how long can he keep running around and climbing out of tombs? That could have really hit us a little harder.
Yeah.
And I think it's sad that they didn't, instead of using that, our natural affinity for Harrison Ford,
yes,
as we come towards the end of his career, they steered away from it. And I thought that was a mistake. Well, you know, feel free to see it if you're an Indiana Jones fan. Again, it's not a terrible movie. It's fun.
No, and I'm sure it will be. There will be cinemas that I'm sure will do reruns of all of them. And I'm sure it will gain a cult following, just as Kingdom of Crystal Skull did. Like, it's, you know what? These movies, they ebb and flow. It wasn't the great joyous send off that I would hope it would be. And I would get, if I felt like it was for a different generation or something, I actually saw it in an early bird screening with captions, and everyone in there was like 70. So it was fantastic.
I saw it Sunday morning.
So it is for a different generation,
like,
actually. Yeah. You're right. But like, I don't feel, it didn't hit with, it seems like, with a wider audience, but you know what? I'm sure it'll find some love, and you'll have fun if you watch it, but it's long.
It is quite long. Up next, Nerd Out.
In today's Nerd Out, where you tell us what you love and why, a theory you're excited to share, or if you have a quick question that we can answer, Cameron offers a secret invasion theory. Hey guys, Cameron from San Jose here. So, Cameron is about to pose a theory that I think would make the most sense for the way they go forward post-Secret Invasion. So, Cameron, I'm saying you should put this on the We Were Right for the future. That's what Cameron says. Just thought I'd submit my theory after watching the premiere of Secret Invasion. After seeing the detainment system the Skrulls are using to trap the humans that they are imitating, I couldn't help but think, this is how we get Black Widow back, right? I can just see the final episode where they're clearing the facility of human prisoners and they find a room with ScarJo. I don't know, maybe a pipe dream, but I'm calling it. Okay, so I'm going to say, now that we're three episodes in, I don't think it's going to happen in the show. But I do think the future of what they do with the Skrulls and this technology is used to bring back Black Widow. You know, you could even, if you wanted to, it's like they saved Tony's body and they, you know, healed him or something. Like, I do think that it will go more comic book heavy in the future. And the fact that the Skrulls have this detainment unit in Secret Invasion, though it is a more grounded show, will be used as a MacGuffin in the future to reintroduce characters that have been sorely missed.
I agree. And I will also say, in the original Secret Invasion, that comic book arc was used to bring back Bobby Morse, Mockingbird, the swashbuckling secret agent, romantic partner of Hawkeye, who had passed away, I don't know, 20 years earlier in real time and was dead. And they used Secret Invasion to bring her back and say, actually, no, she was in Skrull detainment this whole time.
So I think
it can absolutely be done.
I think that is going to be what we see. Will it happen with Black Widow? I don't know. I think they could want to move back to that more traditional Avengers team now that the MCU isn't hitting in the same way. But I think that this is going to happen, whether it's with Black Widow or other characters. I think that though this version of Secret Invasion has not been taken very heavily from the comics, I think we'll see it used and seeded as a way to reintroduce and introduce bigger characters going forward.
Let me ask you this, because I think you're exactly right. And I bet you that some execs at Disney or creative movers and shakers are saying, can we get any of that original cast back?
Yeah.
I think Black Widow is on the table, but at what point, what are the odds that we get, say, Cap or Tony back? Because I think that it could easily happen with the multiverse. Now 100%. You just go to the multiverse and get another one.
We're going to see Steve in the suit again. No question. In my opinion.
I think
that's going to happen. I think Chris Evans loves the character. I think the fans love him. Bucky's still involved so they can come back and recreate. I have always been of the belief post-watching Robert Downey Jr.'s Dr. Dolittle movie that he will be coming back to the MCU. I do believe it will happen. I think Tony is a fair bet. I've always been interested, even from before Endgame, in the idea of doing like the young Tony stuff that they did in the comics where you could have like a younger Tony come in. But I think we could see a Robert Downey Jr. cameo or even with the Skrulls, a potential return. I think it's most likely to happen in the soon to be announced, renamed Avengers movie, Avengers versus X-Men, that I'm sure is going to happen instead of one of the many Kang films that were planned. But I think we could see whenever the X-Men Fantastic Four come back, I think they might try and bring back those original Avengers just for a little bit, just to make
people... Do they do old Cap? Do you think they do old Cap?
Not like Joe Biden Cap from the end of... But maybe he's like... He's kind of more like a rogue, like he's a bit grizzled, a little bit more of like an old man Cap, like how we would call old man Logan in the comics, but not like, I don't think Joe Biden Cap's coming back in that
But
suit.
Not like a shredded comics old Cap.
No,
like
I think that's
You
the
think
more
they do shredded comics old Cap?
I think if they do it, I think it's going to be like old man Logan or old man Deadpool or old man Cap. I would like to see shredded old Cap. Just wait like 20 years till Chris Evans old and then bring him back.
Thanks, Cameron. If you have theories, passions, or quick questions you want to share, hit us up at xray@crooked.com. Instructions in the show notes. Well, that's it for us. Any plugs, Rosie?
Yes, I will be at San Diego Comic-Con this year.
Bum, 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 bum.
If you want to come and see me, I'll be moderating two really cool panels for Webtoon on Thursday morning and Friday morning. I may be announcing something very cool and unexpected, even unexpected to me, on Saturday, but we have to wait and see if that's going to happen. So I'll be in San Diego. So as always, you can spot where I am on Instagram, Rosie Marks, and come and say hi to me. I'll have zines and cool stuff.
Catch the next episode of X-Ray Vision on Friday, July 14th, where we'll be covering episodes 3 and 4 of Secret Invasion.
And you can watch full episodes of the podcast on YouTube. Check us out on Twitter at XRVPod and join our Discord, where the link will be in the show notes so you can hang out with a bunch of cool fans and me and Jason.
Five-star ratings, five-star reviews. We gotta give them to us. Here's one from Mallrat42. One of my favorites. My only complaint is that Jason and Rosie don't cover literally everything I could see. So I guess my real complaint is that the multiverse doesn't actually exist, but that isn't their fault. Thank you so much, Mallrat42.
X-Ray Vision is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Chris Lord and Saul Rubin and executive produced by me, Jason Concepcion. Our editing and sound design is by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Video production by Dylan Villanueva and Rachel Gajewski. Social media by Awa Okolati and Caroline Dunphy. Thank you to Brian Vasquez for our theme music.
See you next time.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.